Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 20th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing the use of disparate impact analysis, a very timely discussion given the court's grant of cert earlier this week in the Mount Holly case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm pleased to welcome to our call today two experts, Mr. Roger Clegg and Professor Theodore Shaw. Roger Clegg is President and General Counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity. He focuses on legal issues arising from civil rights laws, including the regulatory impact on business and the problems in higher education created by affirmative action. Ted Shaw is a professor at Columbia Law School in New York. He was the director, counsel, and president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Legal Defense and Education Fund from 2004 to 2008, and remains one of the nation's leading voices on civil rights. Now, their complete bios are available on our website and in the notice of today's call, so that's all I'm going to say in terms of their credentials. Let's get right to the substance. They're going to each speak for some 6 to 10 minutes, after which we'll have a little discussion and then get to the audience questions. So with that, Mr. Clegg, your opening remarks, please.
Thanks very much, Dean, and thank you to the Federalist Society for having this event, and thanks to Ted Shaw for participating as well. What I'm going to do in my opening here is, first of all, define how the disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement works, then talk a little bit about the different areas where it is used. I'm going to make the point then that the Obama administration has been quite aggressive in its use of the disparate impact approach, and I'm going to critique not so much the Obama administration specifically, but the general approach that is involved in disparate impact litigation, and then talk a little bit about, you know, what is to be done about it. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do all that in 6 to 10 minutes, and I will stop talking when I get to that upper limit, and maybe hope to work some of these points into the Q&A. What is the disparate impact approach to civil rights litigation? Well, you know, if somebody is accused of discriminating on the basis of race, and I'm going to, I think, limit most of my discussion to racial discrimination, but obviously it could apply to, you know, other kinds of discrimination as well. You know, normally what we think of is actions that are motivated by racial animus, or, you know, more precisely, where people are being treated differently because of their race, that either consciously or unconsciously people are being treated one way if they're one color and a different way if they're another color. That is not the approach that the disparate impact approach takes. You can have a practice that is racially neutral by its terms, racially neutral in its intent, and racially neutral in its application, but if it has a disproportionate result, a disproportionate effect, a disparate impact on a particular racial group, then you have made out a prima facie case of discrimination. And the rebuttal is not made by showing that, well, gee, I wasn't actually treating people differently because of race. I wasn't motivated by race or anything like that. The rebuttal is by showing that there is some necessity for using the practice that is being challenged. And in most of these cases, even then, the defendant can lose if the plaintiff can come back and show that, well, there is an alternative selection procedure that would be just as good in meeting this business necessity that you haven't been using. So let me give an example, and I'll use the classic example from the seminal case in this area, which was Griggs versus Duke Power Company. It involved an employer who decided, among other things, that employees had to have a high school diploma. We can think of situations, certainly, where if an employer deliberately decided that he didn't want to hire African Americans and that this was a good way to ensure that not very many African Americans were hired, because in his particular jurisdiction, African Americans tended not to have high school diplomas, that would certainly be objectionable. But that's not what the court said was illegal in the Griggs case. Everybody, that had already been established as illegal. What the court said would be illegal in the Griggs case would be an employer who had adopted the high school diploma requirement without regard to, without any intent of discriminating against this or that racial group. And what the court said in Griggs was that if you do that, and if the plaintiff can show that there is this racial disproportion, then the employer has to show that there is some business necessity for this hiring practice. As I say, the Griggs case was the seminal case in this area, but it has been applied in many other areas too, besides employment. It's applied, for instance, and Dean mentioned, in the fair housing area. So, for instance, if you had a landlord who said that he was not going to rent to people who were unemployed, say, if that practice had a disproportionate effect on this or that racial group, it could be challenged, under this theory, under the Fair Housing Act. Again, even if the landlord was not adopting this because he was trying to keep from renting to a particular racial group, and then the landlord would have to show that there was some reason, some necessity, some degree of necessity for this practice. It's also, so it's used in housing as well as employment. It's used in voting. There's an effects test in the Voting Rights Act. So, for instance, if there was a voter ID law that has a disproportionate effect on the basis of race, it can be challenged. It's used even in the environmental area, where if you have a particular kind of pollution, if it affects an area that geographically tends to be one race than another, it can be challenged. It's used in the school discipline context, that if a school system has a discipline policy that has a disproportionate racial effect, it can also be challenged. I mentioned that I should say also that sometimes the disparate impact approach is written into the statute. It's actually wasn't originally in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. That's the employment part of the Civil Rights Act. But now it is. It was amended by Congress in 1991 to codify the disparate impact approach. It's also explicitly in the Voting Rights Act, which I mentioned, both in Section 2 and in Section 5, although the wording is slightly different in the two statutes. It's not explicitly in the Fair Housing Act, and that's why the Supreme Court has taken the Mount Holly case. It's never resolved the issue of whether the statute itself allows a disparate impact cause of action. It's not in Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which makes it controversial that the Obama administration is using it in the school discipline context, where the regulations under Title VI have a disparate impact approach, even though the statute itself does not. Those regulations, I should say, have been there for a long time. This is not something new with the Obama administration. However, the Obama administration has been quite aggressive in this area, I think it's fair to say. Eric Holder has announced that he and Tom Perez have announced that they wanted to ramp up their use of the disparate impact approach, and they've been true to their word. They have certainly done that. I don't like the disparate impact approach. I think that inevitably it pushes employers to do and others to do one of two things. One is to deliberately take race into account in their practices. If they have a practice that they want to keep, then they have to be sure to apply it in a way that uses surreptitious quotas. Or else they get rid of perfectly legitimate selection devices. I think that any true discrimination can be fought just as effectively under the disparate treatment, classic disparate treatment cases, by showing discriminatory intent. I think I'm coming to the end of my allotted time, so I'll just say that, you know, briefly in terms of what is to be done, certainly the courts are one avenue that can be pursued. Courts can be appealed to not to allow disparate impact causes of action, which is what we're going to do in the Mount Holly case, and urge the Supreme Court not to recognize a disparate impact cause of action under the Fair Housing Act. Justice Scalia, in the New Haven firefighters case, suggested that there might actually be constitutional problems with the disparate impact approach. So this is another way that the courts could limit the use of disparate impact. But finally, this is an area where I think Congress needs to be more active. I think that Congress should certainly stop passing statutes that use the disparate impact approach, and that where the disparate impact approach is being used, they should pass statutes that make it clear that it should not be used. With that, I'm going to turn things over to my friend Ted Shaw.
Well, thank you so much, and I also want to say thank you to the Federalist Society for allowing me to participate in today's discussion. I've come to the point in my life and career where I have done a lot of Federalist Society conventions, meetings, debates, etc., and I always enjoy it. I certainly don't want to only talk to people who share my ideas, and so I welcome these opportunities. I wanted to say that I think that we've heard a very good description of the effects test and where the effects test arise. Won't be a surprise to anyone on the call that or anybody listening that we have some disagreements about its efficacy and whether or not it ought to be used. But let me just say a little bit first about the Mount Holly case, which is up before the Supreme Court and which will be briefed and argued for next term. There were actually a number of questions presented in the cert petition, but the cert petition, which was granted on June 17th, has very explicitly excluded the three-part second question that was presented and presents or focuses only on question one, which is as simply as it can be put, are disparate impact claims cognizable under the Fair Housing Act? The Fair Housing Act was enacted in 1968 after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. It was pending before Congress for quite some time, and it had not moved. And it was only after Dr. King's assassination, and for those who are old enough or historical enough, those aren't necessarily the same thing, to know this, after his assassination, American cities, many of them, including Washington, D.C., went up in flames. There was violence, and, you know, it was a difficult time. But the Fair Housing Act was finally passed, and it was the last major piece of civil rights legislation addressing racial discrimination of the 1960s. It kind of completed the civil rights era civil rights statutes. And if you look at the legislative history of the of Title VIII of the Fair Housing Act, it makes clear that this isn't an ordinary civil rights statute in the sense that it is only prohibitive. It talks about, Congress talked about it and intended there to be an affirmative duty to foster and further integrated housing patterns. And it's in that context, I think, that it's important that one has to understand the effects test. The effects test, as it has been employed pursuant to the Fair Housing Act, has been upheld by every circuit that has reviewed it. And it wasn't much in question for many, many years, although I suspect that that certainly there were those who didn't like it, and it has become a popular target among those whose views are conservative on issues of race and civil rights enforcement. But the idea is that if there are actions that are taken that have an unnecessary discriminatory effect or segregative effect, and they can't be justified, then in those instances, the court will find, or the courts will find, the actions that are under review to be a possible violation. Let me share an experience I had. I started off my legal career at the Justice Department in the Civil Rights Division. Many of us on both sides of the ideological divide on issues of race have Justice Department experience. And I remember at one point, and this is during the Carter administration, the Civil Rights Division was thinking about a case that had to do with minimum lot size ordinances and their effect. And, of course, a minimum lot size can be adopted and employed without racially discriminatory intent. But given the disproportionate impoverishment, or even if not impoverishment, the disproportionate wealth between minority, in particular African-American communities and white communities, it might effectively fence out African-Americans. And so some people were thinking about bringing that suit. The suit wasn't brought. The Assistant Attorney General then was of the view that it was not the kind of case that should be reached under the Fair Housing Act, or at least not on those facts. Maybe he could have come out another way. But he didn't. And I have always thought back to that instance, and I've thought about the effects test generally as being a lower threshold intent case or test. That is to say, you know, race is in the air somewhere. You can smell it, you can sniff it, but the burden isn't as high as it's going to be under the 14th Amendment to prove it. And Congress, in some instances, has made it clear that for policy reasons, the underlying rights or concerns, the initiatives, are important enough to not have that very high bar. And so, you know, I've always looked at it that way. Now, yes, you know, it's correct that the effects test has been employed by the court and by Congress and in Title VII and the regulations under Title VI, but not the statute itself. That gets complicated. We could have more discussion on that, but you've heard a little bit about it. And the Voting Rights Act. Those of us who litigate civil rights cases on behalf of racial minority groups who have been historically discriminated against have thought about the Fair Housing Act as being pretty well settled, but nothing's settled these days, and it doesn't surprise me that it's under attack. it would be a huge reversal and a real blow to what's left of civil rights enforcement if the court were to find that the effects test is, for one reason or another, unconstitutional or otherwise illegal. The question is whether it's cognizable under the Fair Housing Act, and one has to talk about what cognizable means, what kind of standard we're talking about. But in any event, you know, when you put this case, Mount Holly, being before the Supreme Court in the context of a series of cases, Fisher, we're waiting for, Shelby County, we know there's another case out of Michigan involving you know, voter initiative and, you know, diversity efforts. Much of the corpus of civil rights law that was created and won in the aftermath of the civil rights movement is under siege and at risk. And that's true of the Fair Housing Act also. So folks in the civil rights community are very concerned about this. We'll see what the court does. I'll probably stop there so that we can get to question and answers. The one other thought I'll share very briefly is that, as I think is clear, where you don't have a justification for a standard that's being applied that fences out disproportionately people of color, and it's not necessary, as is true under Griggs v. Duke Power Company and Title VII, I don't quite understand what the concerns are about changing those policies. It seems to me that there's a lot of reason to do it, a lot of wisdom in doing it. If you can show that it's a necessary qualification, then, you're in different grounds. But where it's unnecessary, then I don't see why people want to fight that, but maybe we can hear more about that. So again, thank you for allowing me to participate, and I don't know if we get rebuttal now or go straight to questions, but I'll cease for the time being.
All right, thank you very much. This is Dean Reuter again. Why don't we do just very short responses? And before we do that, let me open the floor to questions so people can begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either or perhaps both of our experts, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold on for that. So once again, if you have a question for our experts, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the audience, let me make a quick announcement about a call that we just scheduled for tomorrow. I think everybody on this call follows the Supreme Court. It came out with a handful of decisions today, and we've been able to schedule a call for tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, where we'll be joined by two experts, one of whom will talk about the USAID versus OSI case, sort of a free speech case, and that's Eric Jaffe taking that case. And then we'll hear from Andy Pincus, who's going to be talking about the American Express versus Italian Colors decision that came out today. That's a class action arbitration case. Let's go back to Roger Clegg. Roger, is it just a matter of the presumption or of who's right and who's wrong, or do you have a response to Ted Shaw? And please just take literally a minute or two, because I see that we've got a handful of questions already from our audience. And then we'll
sure.
go back to Professor Shaw for his response.
Sure. No, I'll try to be very brief. And I should point people to the amicus brief that Pacific Legal Foundation filed, and that the Center for Equal Opportunity and Cato and the Competitive Enterprise Institute all joined in the Mount Holly case that goes into a lot more detail on this. I don't want to, you know, get too much into the weeds about, you know, the legislative history of the Fair Housing Act and all that. I will mention that it's not a brand new challenge to say that it doesn't allow a disparate impact cause of action. When I was in the Reagan administration, we argued that before the Supreme Court, which did not resolve the issue. President Reagan, in the signing statement for the 1988 amendments to the Fair Housing Act, said that it allowed only disparate treatment causes of action. I think, to answer your question, Dean, and to answer Ted's last point there, you know, the problem is that sort of saying that, well, you know, look, all you have to do is just go into court and convince a judge or a jury that you have a sufficiently valid reason, you know, for this business practice. That's actually asking quite a bit. You know, litigation is expensive. Judges are unpredictable. Juries are unpredictable. I, you know, was sort of taken aback by the example that Ted gave of this, you know, this the small lot case. I'm glad that, you know, the Civil Rights Division, you know, exercises, I used to work there too, you know, exercises some discretion on which of these cases to bring. But another way of looking at that is it makes it very arbitrary, you know, for the, you know, for the municipality that's trying to decide whether to, you know, adopt an ordinance like that, you know, whether they are going to get sued or not. You know, it all depends on whether, you know, Ted Shaw thinks that there's race in the air. And I think that that makes it, you know, that's not the way that the laws are supposed to work. I should also give, you know, maybe a few more, you know, dramatic examples of the kinds of things that, you know, this administration in particular has been pushing. They've announced that, you know, criminal background checks by employers are something that they are going to, you know, look askance at. And indeed, in the last, you know, week or two, they have, you know, brought some action. You know, there again, I think that, you know, it's very easy to understand why employers might want to be careful about hiring people with, you know, with criminal records. And, you know, the question is whether, you know, assuming that they're not doing this for racially, you know, discriminatory reasons, assuming that they may not even know if a policy has a disparate impact or not, why should it be up to a jury to decide if this is something that is, you know, sufficiently justified for business reasons rather than the company itself?
Professor Shaw, you want to take a minute or two?
Absolutely. Well, first, I want to assure the audience that when Roger said it depended on whether Ted Shaw thought race was in the air, that he wasn't really saying that I have that kind of power. He knows I don't. But he's talking about whether somebody who is in charge with enforcing the law thinks so. But I did run the Legal Defense Fund. I worked there for about a quarter of a century, and I can tell you that when we brought cases, we thought long and hard about the merits of those cases, and that isn't going to assure Roger or many other people about the merits of the case. But people just don't fly off and file litigation at the Justice Department or at the Legal Defense Fund or organizations like that without thinking long and hard about the merits of these cases. As Roger says, litigation is expensive, and you want to make sure that there are merits to the cases that you bring. Having said that, you know, it's interesting because maybe Roger is a little taken aback about the fact that there's an instance in which a case wasn't filed, if he assumes that that all the cases that can be filed on any theory aren't, but or are filed, but they're not. You know, that is to say that in that instance, that was stretching the effects test too far. At least that's what the Justice Department folks at that time thought. I like his example about criminal background checks, though, because there's an instance where I would say race is in the air. You know, the facts are out now. A huge part. I'm not talking about violent crimes. You know, everybody's concerned about that, and ought to be concerned about people who are violent criminals. You know, people have been convicted of certain kind of crimes, you know, working in certain kinds of jobs, or et cetera. But the facts are out that black folks don't use drugs in higher proportions than white folks. And look at the marijuana reports recently and the huge over-incarceration rates of African-Americans for marijuana violations. And you think about how that plays out in terms of the hiring process, if somebody can be dinged, can be denied an employment opportunity because they have marijuana arrests, when we have white folks smoking marijuana at the same rates or higher, but the criminal justice system operates in a very racially discriminatory way. I say that the effects test in that instance might serve some good, but it's not a one-size-fits-all scenario, and I think that that folks are generally careful about how they apply it.
All right, very good. Let's turn to the audience now. If you want to join the queue, we've got three people with questions so far. You need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy at the Committee for Justice. I first wanted to say hi to my friends Roger and Ted, and then ask, this question is mostly for Ted, and it's about when it comes to disparate impact and housing, how do we separate out race and income? In other areas of civil rights, say, admissions, the link is not as clear. We can debate whether being poor affects how you do on the SAT, and thus whether the SAT has a racially disparate impact on admissions. But with housing, there's no doubt. Nobody could doubt for a moment that being poor affects your choices about where you can live. The number one determinant of where you can live is how much money you make. And so how do we, let's say we do keep the effects test, how do we stop it from just becoming basically a statute that prohibits discrimination or really any differentiation based on income? So that's my first question. I also was curious about Ted's statement that that he's not happy with the level of enforcement of civil rights, that there's not much of it left. And I was just curious whether he thinks that even applies to the Holder Justice Department.
Well, first, Kurt, how you doing? It's good to hear from you, and hope to catch up with you. The question, Kurt, that you're asking about income or class or economic status as opposed to race is a good question. I think it points back in some ways to the example I use with respect to minimum lot size ordinances. There clearly it affects somebody on the basis of economic status or wealth. But the question is, at least in my mind, whether it was adopted with race in mind. As I said earlier, I've long thought of the effects test as, for the most part, not being a pure effects test, rather, but a kind of lower threshold intent or races in the air test, which I understand Roger doesn't quite feel comfortable with. But I would think that, that's a check or a break on these instances that he might be concerned about with respect to just applying anything that has any disparate impact to any practice.
But that's the way the law works.
Let me finish.
Let me put it this way. Justice Scalia said that he might be okay constitutionally if there was an opportunity in Title VII cases for the employer to show, as an affirmative defense, that he had non-racial reasons for adopting, say, a particular firefighter exam. Now, what I hear you saying is that's the way that you think the disparate impact approach should work. That is, it's really not a pure effects test. It's used only in instances where, you can somebody thinks that there's discrimination afoot, but they can't quite prove it. Wouldn't you at least be willing in a case like that to say that, well, look, if the employer or the landlord can come into court and himself prove that race is not in the air, that the reason that he adopted this criminal background check, or the reason that he adopted this, whatever it is that's being challenged, was for non-racial reasons. He can prove that.
Well,
that,
you know,
therefore, that he should win the case.
Go ahead, Professor Strong.
Yeah,
Professor Shaw, go ahead.
Thank you. The other piece of it that I wanted to get to was there's the Griggs v. Duke type example where a practice, a hiring practice, is adopted, which has disproportionate effect on grounds of race. And there's no justification for it. It's unnecessary. The employer can't, regardless of how much discrimination or discriminatory intent may be in the air, there's just no justification for it. There I would say that I'm very comfortable with the effects test being used in the way it has been used. The effects test in the Fair Housing Act has been in place now since 1968, as we talked about, and the sky hasn't fallen. And in fact, the truth is that it's been a statute that has been under-enforced during Democratic and Republican administrations. We still have a great deal of housing discrimination and segregation that is in play. So it's not like this test has hamstrung, housing providers, landlords, et cetera. In some ways, I'd say that the test needs to be, the statute needs to be enforced more strongly. My view is that that this is not a statute that ought to be reviewed in terms of the standard for enforcement. It stood for 4 decades or so, and every court that has reviewed it, at the appellate court level, has upheld it, and as Roger indicated, he acknowledged the Supreme Court had an opportunity to strike down the effects test years ago, didn't do it, let it stand. And the signing statement by President Reagan really doesn't surprise me, doesn't add a whole lot. It's not like he was a super civil rights enforcer. That's an understatement. So to the second question with respect to this administration and enforcement efforts, I was not saying that this administration is not trying to enforce civil rights law. What I'm pointing to is an attack that's been underway, and you all know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, for some time now on the corpus of established civil rights case law and statutes. That is finally coming to fruition, what I would call the conservative project on race, and it's manifested in these cases that I've mentioned in the Supreme Court, whether we're talking about Fisher, Shelby County, Mount Holly, Title VII isn't going to escape being revisited, I'm sure, at some point. The effects test is an important part of that project that that you all have been working on.
Well, I certainly agree that there's an important conservative agenda in this area, and that agenda is to ensure that the civil rights laws are enforced in a non-preferential way. And
well, how do we get the preferences
instance, you brought up the Fisher case as being part of the agenda, and I think that the disparate impact area works into it quite logically, that we don't think that the law should be enforced in a racially preferential way. We don't think that the Constitution should prohibit some kinds of discrimination and racial discrimination in university admissions, but not others. We think that all groups should be protected from discrimination, and I think that the problem.
Well, I agree. All groups should be protected from discrimination, but we're talking about the Fair Housing Act here. So are we really talking about preferences under the Fair Housing Act?
No.
I didn't think so.
But you brought up Fisher, Ted, and I'm explaining why we're taking the position that we took in Fisher. And with respect to disparate impact, the problem with the disparate impact approach is that it pushes employers, in many cases, to hire with an eye on race. And this is no secret. You know this is true, Ted, that, for instance, with firefighter exams, with police exams, that has been the result of the disparate impact approach. That's exactly what had happened in the New Haven case. And that's what prompted Justice Scalia to say that there is this problem with the whole disparate impact approach, that it is telling employers that if they fail to hit the right numbers, then they are liable to lawsuits.
Well,
and
as a result,
you see discrimination like there was in the Fair Housing Act, in the New Haven case. The point is that if when you start making it illegal not to make decisions in a way that leads to a politically correct racial and ethnic mix, you are encouraging discrimination.
That was a tortured way of trying to get at something, which I think indicates that you're working a little too hard to point to a problem that I think is being overstated. We could talk about Ricci, and I'd be glad to talk about that. I'm not going to tell you that there are instances in which a city or an employer couldn't have done something better in terms of their hiring process. And we could talk about Ricci, and I can tell you what I thought would have been better in Ricci. But if your position is that across the board and as a general matter, employers, fire departments, police departments, et cetera, are hiring on a quota basis, and there's widespread discrimination going on, giving preferences to minority group members, African Americans. I mean, the numbers don't bear that out. The facts don't bear that out. I mean, you look at the litigation that's been pending in New York City before the federal court and the fire department here. The fire department in New York City, where I live, has long been virtually all white, vastly disproportionate in terms of its numbers as compared to the general population. And the court isn't saying that the fire department has to hire a proportionate number of African Americans or Latinos. But you have what is, long understood to be, a fire department that that engages in exclusionary hiring practices, and there's a lot of nepotism, et cetera, and black folks lose out. They're almost non-existent. So we're not talking about quotas. We're talking about whether or not these departments have hiring practices and policies that are fair, and one of the things that helps to smoke that out is the effects test when the standards that are being employed have an unnecessarily discriminatory effect.
Well, let me go back then, Ted, and ask you the question that I asked before. If you have a situation where an employer has been sued under a disparate impact theory, and that employer can prove that, in fact, the reason that he adopted this test was not to be exclusionary, was not to keep from hiring black people, but that they had hired a firm to put together the best test that they could to hire policemen, and that's what they did, and he can document all that proves that he did not have discriminatory intent in what he was doing, would you hold that employer liable?
Well,
do you think that the law should be changed so that employer is not liable? Because the way it is now, he would still be liable. It's completely irrelevant that
he had no discriminatory intent. The question then becomes to me whether the hiring practice that's at issue is one that is necessary for that job, whether or not it points to a real bona fide job qualification. Because even if he's not, or she or it is not engaging in invidious, discriminatory intent, if the employer is using a test that's not validated for the purpose for which it's being used, if it's unnecessary, for determining who's qualified to do the job, then, I'm still in favor of an effects test and saying that the employer should be banned from using that test. And I'm not sure why anybody else wouldn't be under those circumstances. If it's validated, if it's necessary, then we're talking about a different scenario. And if they've rebutted the fact that or the allegation that they're engaging in discriminatory conduct and this is a necessary qualification, then we're on different grounds.
Yeah, I just think that's a very odd approach. You know, you have an employer and, by agreement now, this is an employer who is not acting for any kind of discriminatory motive. You know, he has adopted this test, and yet you think that it should be up to a judge, or a jury, to decide whether the business reasons for that are persuasive, to this judge. If it should be up to the employer, so long as he is not acting, with bad racial motives. We don't generally have judges and juries decide whether, there are persuasive economic justifications for things that companies do.
And I equally believe, you say I have an odd approach. I equally believe you have an odd approach in supporting standards that unnecessarily screen out for people who are qualified by using hiring criteria that, for example, aren't validated for that purpose, and you have an unnecessary discriminatory effect. I don't see why you would want to let that stand.
But that's why
it's interesting that we have different. Different people with different views, and
it is interesting. And let me. This is Dean Reuter. Let me interrupt because we're going over the same ground a couple times here. We've got a couple questions left. We've got about 10 minutes left.
Okay.
Let me ask you though, each of you though, Roger, would you be more sanguine about this approach if it were applied only to employers who had some history of discrimination, or maybe even if not to a particular employer, fields of employment that had a history of discrimination with some level of intent?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, will enable me to make a point that I wanted to make earlier, which is that sometimes, the effects test is described as, and I saw this when Mount Holly was granted, that the sort of shorthand that journalists use was to say that effects tests use statistical evidence. And that is certainly true, that as a general matter, effects tests do, but you can use statistical evidence in a disparate treatment case too. And I'm happy for the Civil Rights Division, when it brings a civil a lawsuit, to use all kinds of evidence in order to show disparate treatment, in order to show discriminatory intent. And the Supreme Court, laid all this out in the Arlington Heights decision. You can look at the statistical impact of a practice. You can look at the history that somebody has had. Those are all things that I think are appropriately brought into the mix. But the ultimate question has to be whether people are being treated differently because of race. And if you can prove that, then fine. You've shown a civil rights violation, and the employer or the landlord, whoever it is, should be held liable. But if you can't show that, then you haven't violated the civil rights laws.
You may not have done
things in the most efficient way, according to a judge, but it's really not the judge's duty to do anything except to decide whether you have treated somebody differently because of skin color.
Dean, let me just say one other thing. I know we want to get to other questions, but, in spite of what we hear sometimes from some folks, we don't have a raging liberal federal judiciary these days. One of the things that I really want to underscore is that you have people who are judges on the bench who can sort through the kind of evidence that we're talking about in these cases and can make a determination about when it's appropriate to apply the effects test in a way that allows plaintiffs to prevail. But it's very important to understand that, you know, we don't have, for the most part, the kind of clumsy, you know, stupid, outrageous, you know, discrimination that we had 40 or 50 years ago. And a lot of people are very much more subtle in their behavior these days. We're talking about a different kind of discrimination that occurs these days. The effects test reaches some of that discrimination where people may engage in actions that unnecessarily fence people out from opportunities, whether we're talking about employment or the Fair Housing Act.
Are you then, Professor, making the argument that there should be intent, as it sort of maybe a moral proposition, somebody should only be guilty of discrimination if there is intent, but this it's just too difficult to improve to prove that intent, and this makes
No. I'm not going that far because, as I said, there may be, and there are examples of actors who employ criteria that simply are unnecessarily discriminatory, whatever their intent might be. And where you can't justify that, where it's unnecessary, but it has discriminatory effect, why not adopt a policy or a practice that doesn't have discriminatory effect and that still allows the employer or, you know, in the case of, you know, housing, the landlord, et cetera, to pursue their legitimate ends, but not in a way that has unnecessarily discriminatory effects. So I'm not willing to go as far as I think your question implies and say, no, this is only about purely intentional discrimination. But I'm saying that the effects test often has been used in ways that gets at discrimination where race is in the air, you know, or, you know, people are conscious of race, even if it's not their primary motivator, as in the case of the employment concerns we talked about with respect to people with criminal records.
All right. We've got three questions pending now. We've got about 7 minutes. Let's try and get through these. And I'm going to ask the callers to be as brief as possible in laying out their questions.
Hi, this is Will Hahn. This question is for Professor Shaw. Question I have is, first and foremost, is there any kind of principled basis for limiting the scope of the effects test that you would sign on to? You've mentioned some pragmatic limitations in terms of we think really hard about these cases before we bring them. We're not endorsing quotas. But it seems to me that we're still suing someone for taking race into account, and we want to try and deter that by telling them to consider racial outcomes in statistics, if not to avoid a lawsuit in the first place. And related to that, Roger Clegg brought up the criminal background checks. Should we be suspicious of juries as well? Because they check for criminals too, and proportionately more African Americans turned up in those checks than white Americans. And I'm just wondering if that disparate impact, which is now endorsed by the government because it happens in a judicial government proceeding, is, you know, impermissible discrimination, and the government should be held liable for that.
Well, given the limitations of time, I know I can't do justice to the last part of the question with respect to juries. There's a great deal that we could say about jury selection, but the point that I was trying to get at is it goes to the fact that we have a criminal justice system that now pretty much has been demonstrably shown to be tilted racially in an unfair way, and with especially when we talk about marijuana convictions. And if you're not familiar with all of that evidence, I just encourage you to take a look at it because it's quite stunning. But to go back to this notion, I guess your question went to whether there's any principled way of avoiding putting people in a position of making decisions because they're afraid of being sued. You know, I'm not sure that that's exactly the way the world works. I mean, I think that, you know, I would say that that's crying wolf. We don't want people to be acting because they're afraid of being sued. We want people to engage in practices, policies, and conduct that A is not intentionally discriminatory, but also that doesn't have a discriminatory effect that's not justifiable or unnecessary. There are a lot of things that have disproportionate effect that remain in place that we're not, you know, that don't get touched. There are a lot of things. But there are some things that that I think ought to be reached by considerations of race with respect to non-discriminatory and unnecessarily discriminatory effect. And that's what the effects test works at or toward.
All right, two questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Matthew Schmidt, and I just graduated from Columbia Law School. I have a question for my wonderful former CIFPO teacher, Professor Shaw. Professor Shaw, I want to go back to the question you've asked, or the point you've made a few times about if a practice is not necessary, shouldn't the best policy be to have the employer avoid it? And when you say it that way, it sounds really commonsensical and extremely compelling. But I wonder if you would concede that the argument is a little less neat when you consider that the adjudications are not costless. So you have the cost associated with true negatives, so where a defendant ultimately wins, it's costly to win, and of course false negatives, which has both the normal cost of true negatives and then the judgment cost in a lawsuit they should have won. Because the end result would be they wouldn't just avoid practices that aren't necessary, but might on the margins at least avoid first best practices in favor of second best practices to avoid litigation risk. And I wonder if you would consider when you think about the cost, that at least makes that argument a little less neat, even if you might still agree with it ultimately.
Oh, it might be, yeah. Well, I take the point. It might be a little less neat. But by the way, this is one of my favorite students, so it's good to hear from you, Matthew. I take the point. But I go back to the point I made before, which is that litigation is costly, but it's costly for both sides. I'm not sure that anybody, you know, the notion that civil rights plaintiffs want to jump into litigation and they do it, thoughtlessly, because they can, I think that's misplaced. But I take the point that you just made, and I think, yeah, it's less neat, but I still stay in the same place. It's not a neat world.
Let me ask both our speakers if they – we have one question pending. Do you both have time to take this final question, or should we adjourn the call now?
Oh, I'm good.
I am too.
Okay. Well, let's take this final question.
Well, thanks for taking my questions, guys. This is Michael Rossman with the Center for Individual Rights.
Oh, I changed my mind.
You know, how come everybody who's calling we know? Where's the rest of the world? Where are you?
Well, you know, the people who know you are attracted to the call. You can take it as a compliment.
Yeah, well, that's I'll take it that way. Good to hear from you.
So my question really relates to the question of remedies for disparate impact violations. Disparate impact is the law, but what happens when people find a violation of disparate impact about a selection device, let's say, that took place 2, 3, 4 years ago? Hiring has already been done.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, if they didn't use that selection device, they might have used some other selection device. We don't know what the selection device they would have used is, and we don't know who would have been successful on it. So it seems to me one of the difficulties of the disparate impact theory is figuring out what to do once you have actually found a violation. This is for both of you, either of you. If you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
I was going to ask Michael, explain how that's different. It's different in the disparate impact context than in a disparate treatment case. I mean, suppose.
Well, certainly in a disparate treatment case, I mean, there's a question of whether or not the person who's suing is qualified. And if they used race, the assumption is, you know, the employer has this opportunity in the disparate treatment instance of saying, well, even if we, you know, it's true, you know, you've shown race, but even if we had not used race, wouldn't have hired this particular person because X. And it seems to me much more difficult to do that in the disparate impact situation because you don't know what the criteria would have been if you're not using this election device that, in fact, in history, you did use. So I do think it's different for that reason.
Who wants to respond first, Professor Shaw?
Well, I'm interested in hearing what Roger has to say about this.
Well, I'm always open to new objections to make to the disparate impact approach, but I have to say, Michael Rossman is a distinguished lawyer with the Center for Individual Rights and knows more about, has litigated many more of these cases than I have. But I'm not sure that I quite see that there's that dramatic a difference, Michael, in this case. I mean, you could have a disparate treatment, right, class action, where, let's say it's in the disparate impact context, and in this context, it was the same test. Okay, it's a paper and pencil test for firefighters, and in one case, what the plaintiff can show is that there was, a disparate impact that was not justified by business necessity. What he shows in the other instance is that there was discriminatory motive.
Certainly a class action disparate treatment case would be much. There would be a good similarity between the two. I was thinking in disparate treatment, I was thinking more of the individual hiring case rather than disparate treatment in the use of the selection device.
And are you also thinking primarily of damages?
Damages, reinstatement as a potential remedy, or a promotion if it was a job that was in-house. Those are all possible remedies, but it seems to me it's very difficult, extremely difficult when you're talking about the disparate impact situation to sort of figure out what would have happened in the hypothetical universe of a different selection device.
Well, maybe this is an area where Roger and I have more agreement, because I think that whatever difficulties might exist, they arise in both disparate treatment and disparate effects cases. Very often, you're trying to, reconstruct a world in disparate treatment cases where you're also looking at a class of competitors for the opportunity that may be difficult to assemble completely. So I think those difficulties may exist in both circumstances. If you're talking about anything other than damages, I'm not sure the concern is as great, but maybe you'll correct me on this. The reason I say that is because if you can show that the practice wasn't justified, wasn't a job necessity, and they engaged in it and had unnecessary discriminatory effect, then I think what you do is, what you're talking about is changing the practice very often. And often, the individuals who might have been affected by it, they're not necessarily the ones who are going to get the relief in terms of the opportunity, if you're talking about employment.
Right. Forward-looking relief is,
that's right,
is sort of unobjectionable.
Yeah.
And I take Michael's point. I mean, I think that it certainly is more difficult to figure out what would have happened and what should the employer have done in the disparate impact context than in the disparate treatment context.
You can have an expert in employment practices who can talk about what a non-discriminatory practice with respect to effects might have looked like. But it's hard for me to say more about that outside the context of a factually specific case.
Well, gentlemen, let's let this be our final word today. We're into overtime here. But I do want to thank Professor Ted Shaw and Roger Clegg for joining us today, especially for sticking around late. It's been a very interesting discussion. To our audience, a reminder that we have a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. when Eric Jaffe and Andy Pincus will be discussing two of today's important decisions issued by the Supreme Court. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.